update your home and save big money with Mastercraft Doors at Menards. For over 50 years, Mastercraft has been making quality doors inside and out. Choose from the best in-stock selection of interior and exterior doors ready to take home today. Or design your door your way with our free designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on Mastercraft Doors and check out more great deals happening now at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online. After midnight.
Some stories don't just sit quietly in the past. They bleed forward. They linger. They remind you that once you've opened a door to something you don't understand, it's not always as simple as shutting it again. Kevin is 27 now. He lives in South Florida. By most accounts, his life looks normal. He works, he socializes, he parties, he wakes up and checks his phone like everyone else. But the shadows he's lived with, shadows that began clawing their way into his life when he was just a boy, haven't left. He says this story stretches back decades, that it began with family tragedy and grief, that it was fed by his own curiosity, and that at its peak, it nearly broke him. And the most unnerving part? He doesn't think it's over. When Kevin was little, his mother told him they had a strong spiritual connection, that their family was tuned differently. More sensitive to the currents most people never notice. Kevin remembers constant deja vu, unusual dreams, strange flashes that felt more like premonition than fantasy. But as a kid, you don't know what to do with that kind of information. You just live. Loss came early. At 6, his cousin died of a rare disease. A year later, his grandmother passed away from cancer, and only a few years after that, his uncle ended his own life. For a child, these events are confusing enough. For a child already predisposed to sensing the world differently, they planted questions far bigger than his age could handle. But nothing prepared him for what happened when he was 12. Her name was Terry, 4 years older. His sister, she died in a car accident. Kevin was devastated. By then, his parents had separated, and he was living with his mother in a small duplex. She worked constantly to provide for him, which meant he spent long stretches of time alone. Too much time alone with grief. He remembers lying in Terry's room after she died just to feel close to her, her bed, her things, the faint scent of her perfume still hanging in the air. Sometimes her clock radio would turn itself on while he was there. The speakers squealed with static, high-pitched and sharp enough to raise goosebumps across his arms. But Kevin didn't fear it. He embraced it. "Is that you, Terry?" he would whisper. "Give me a sign." And the radio would scream back at him. He believed it was her that she was answering, trying to tell him she was still there. And even though the sound chilled him, it made him happy. It gave him something to cling to. For a while, she even came to him in dreams, sitting beside him, comforting him, reminding him that she loved him. But as the months dragged on and the morning stretched into something unbearable, even those dreams stopped. And when they did, something darker took notice. It began one ordinary afternoon. Kevin had come home from school, made himself lunch, and sat in front of the TV. The quiet was normal, the house was familiar, but the feeling wasn't. He felt it before he heard it, a presence, heavy, suffocating, as though someone was standing directly behind him, close enough that their breath should have touched the back of his neck. The goosebumps were instant, his eyes stung with tears he couldn't explain. He turned to look, nothing. He turned again, still nothing. 20 times he checked, 20 times he told himself he was being paranoid. And then it spoke, a deep, guttural voice, evil in its resonance. It spoke only once, but once was enough. It said his name, Kevin Bolted. He didn't go back to that house for more than a week. He stayed with a friend down the street, too terrified to return. His mother told him it was in his head, but Kevin knew what he'd heard, knew what he'd felt. This wasn't imagination. This was intrusion. He clutched his father's cross, placed it in his room, and prayed. And though nothing like that happened in that duplex again, Kevin knew the world he had stepped into was real. The family eventually moved, using the insurance money from Terry's death to settle into a nicer home in a suburban neighborhood 20 minutes away. For a while, Kevin was fine. The new house, the new friends, the fresh start, it all seemed to heal him. He lived like a normal teenager. For a time, he believed maybe the darkness had been left behind with that old duplex. But death has a way of following you. When Kevin turned 16, his father died after a long illness. The grief was crushing. He smiled in public, laughed when he was supposed to, but inside he was unraveling. And that's when he made the mistake that would open the door again. He tried to contact his father through a Ouija board. It wasn't anything elaborate, just a cheap toy store board. He and his girlfriend sat down, placed their fingers on the planchette, and asked if his father was there. At first, it felt like a joke, the kind of thing you do at sleepovers to scare yourself. But the planchette began to move. Slowly, carefully, it began spelling answers. Kevin thought his girlfriend was pushing it. He asked for proof, something undeniable. The board spelled 3 letters. R-A-T. Kevin laughed. How stupid. He didn't think much of it until later that night when he and his girlfriend were lying on the couch watching TV. A loud crash broke the silence. They rushed into the kitchen, and there it was, a large rat perched on the counter, the first and last time Kevin ever saw one in that house. The board had delivered. Kevin was convinced now, and worse, he was scared. The dreams came next, vivid, comforting at first. Dreams of his father, his sister, his grandmother, his uncle, all of them together, driving in a convertible beneath a sunlit sky. They told him it was going to be okay, that they loved him, that one day he would understand. But good dreams never last, not when the door you've opened swings both ways. Because with his mind opened, his grief laid bare, other things found him. Things that weren't families, things that weren't comforting, things that stalked him. It was Halloween. Kevin's mother decided to throw a party at the house. The air was thick with music, laughter, and the kind of nervous energy that comes when the living celebrate in the shadow of the dead. Kevin had friends over, and his sister was visiting from out of town. They all gathered in his bedroom, swapping ghost stories, daring each other into laughter. Kevin told them about the Ouija board, about the rat, about the dreams that weren't really dreams, and then, as if summoned by coincidence or fate, his sister's friend spoke up. He was older, carried himself differently. He said he practiced Wicca, and more than that, he had a powerful Ouija board in his car. Not the flimsy cardboard ones sold in toy aisles. This one was different. Kevin, already convinced that the cheap board had worked, felt a rush of curiosity. If the mass-produced one could open a door, what could something older, darker, more deliberate do? They told him to bring it in. When the man returned, he carried a black case with golden clips. He laid it down carefully, like someone revealing a weapon. Inside was a board unlike anything Kevin had seen before. Solid black, engraved with golden symbols. The planchette was carved from ivory, its window a circle of clear crystal. It radiated significance, weight, danger. They began to play, fingers brushing lightly over the planchette. At first, it was harmless. The questions were silly, the answers light, even comical. The group laughed nervously, teasing each other about who might be pushing it, and then The mood changed. The answers turned sharp, cruel. A darkness seemed to seep into the room itself, an icy shift in the air. The laughter died. Goosebumps rose on every arm. One friend asked about her grandmother, who had recently passed away. "Do you know my grandma?" she asked the board. "Yes. Can you get her number?" "Why not? Do you know where she is?" "Yes." "Where?" The planchette glided, deliberate and slow, spelling the word with brutal clarity. H-E-L-L. Then one more word. Suffering. The girl burst into tears. The room went silent, every face pale. The air grew heavy, oppressive. The Wiccan friend's demeanor changed instantly. He demanded the entity's name. The planchette stilled, then moved again, tracing three letters. Z-A-M. The man stiffened. He whispered that this was no ordinary spirit, but something else. Something dangerous. A demon. And then he did something that terrified Kevin more than anything else that night. He left, gathered his board, snapped the golden clips shut, and walked out of the house without another word. Kevin never saw him again. For weeks afterward, Kevin's room felt poisoned, cold, heavy. He couldn't sleep there. He would linger in the hall, staring at the door, feeling the pull of something waiting on the other side. Eventually, he forced himself back in, forced himself to reclaim the space, but the house wasn't finished with him. One afternoon, Kevin came home from school. The house was quiet, his mother still at work. He walked down the hall toward his room. As he passed his mother's bedroom, something made him stop. He didn't know why. Just an instinct, a whisper in his gut that told him to look inside. He stood there staring at the bed. And then he heard it. That voice, the same voice from years earlier in the duplex. Deep, dark, drenched in malice. Said his name. Kevin froze. His body betrayed him, locked in place as tears welled in his eyes. Goosebumps rippled across his skin. The fear was pure. Primal. And then, like before, he ran. He tried to convince himself he was crazy, that he was imagining it. But no, this wasn't a trick of the mind. The voice was too clear, too real. The thing that had found him years ago had followed him. And now it was stronger. The nights grew worse. One evening, Kevin lay in bed, the lights off, eyes adjusted to the darkness. The silence wasn't empty. It was crowded. Filled with a sense of being observed. He kept hearing faint movements like something brushing against the furniture. He told himself maybe it was his dog, but then remembered he had closed the door. His dog was outside. And then it touched him, not a hand, not skin. Something colder, something charged like static electricity. A jolt on his leg, traveling upward toward his knee. He lay frozen, heart hammering, trying to stay still. Maybe if he didn't react, it would leave. The touch paused. Then came back, harder this time. The sensation of being punched, but laced with electricity. Like being shocked by a live wire. He refused to move. Refused to give it the satisfaction. But then it struck his chest. The blow forced him upright, eyes snapping open. He gasped, ready to run. And that's when it pounced. A crushing weight slammed him back into the bed, his lungs compressed under the force. He couldn't breathe, couldn't scream, couldn't move. The weight pressed down, pinning him, electricity coursing through every muscle like a current. 10 seconds, 15, long enough to feel endless. And then just like that, it was gone. Kevin bolted from his room, screaming, stumbled into the yard and collapsed on his knees, gasping for air, trembling, tears running down his face. His mother told him it was just a dream. Sleep paralysis, maybe. But Kevin wasn't tired. He hadn't been drifting off. He was awake. He was certain. This wasn't sleep paralysis. This was assault. The weeks that followed dragged him into darker places. His depression deepened. He isolated himself, shut himself in his room, drowning out the silence with music. He began cutting himself, razor blades tracing lines into his arms, not to die, but to feel something, anything. Other than fear, the pain became its own kind of relief, and then came the blackouts. Hours at a time, gone, He would find himself in places he didn't remember walking to, hear from friends about things he had said that he didn't recall. His mother, horrified, would look at him and whisper, "Who are you? Your eyes. They're not your eyes." He left Florida for a while, hoping distance would help. He stayed with his sister in another state, but the darkness traveled with him. She said he terrified her, that he wandered the house at night, muttering, growling, speaking in his sleep, with a voice that didn't sound like his own. When she confronted him, he screamed at her, rage boiling out of nowhere. Even she didn't want him there. He booked a ticket home, half because he missed Florida and half because he could feel himself unraveling in a house where even family was starting to watch him with the same suspicion he'd learned to have for mirrors. On the flight, he took the aisle seat and tried not to think. But the universe has a way of seating you where you'll be forced to listen. The man beside him asked the kind of small talk questions strangers ask when they notice the storm in your eyes. Where are you headed? What do you do? What's your family like? And then, almost gently, what do you believe? Kevin shrugged. He wasn't sure anymore. The man nodded like he'd expected that answer and said he was a pastor who spent most of his life abroad doing mission work. If Kevin ever wanted to talk, really talk, he should call. Kevin pocketed the card without looking at it. Destiny seldom looks like destiny when it's printed in black ink and tucked next to an airline napkin. He didn't plan to call, but the pastor did. A week after they landed, the phone rang and the stranger's voice returned, steady and unhurried. He wanted to come by. Talk. Pray, maybe. Bring a couple of people from his church. Kevin handed the phone to his mother and let her handle the logistics. Part of him bristled. Part of him hoped. They arrived at sunset, the pastor and two others carrying nothing that looked like Hollywood. No crucifixes large enough to club a demon. No vials of theatrical smoke. Just soft voices. A Bible rubbed thin at the edges. A patience that didn't flinch at the edges of Kevin's story. He told them everything. The radio, the first voice that said his name, the rat spelled out on a board and then conjured on a countertop, the crushing weight, the blackouts, the blade. He told them about Zam. He told them about how his mother had begun to look at him like she didn't recognize the boy she raised. The pastor listened as if every detail mattered. Then he said something Kevin will never forget. "There is a war, and not all of it can be seen." He wasn't trying to frighten him. He sounded like a doctor explaining a diagnosis, calm and clinical. He described the difference in his tradition between possession and oppression, the way something can lean on a person, seep in at the seams, exploit grief and exhaustion until the mind becomes a doorway. He talked about doorways, about how toys aren't toys when grief is the hand that lifts them, about how curiosity opens you and pain keeps you open. They asked to step into his room. The very air seemed heavier there, as if heat could have weight. They prayed. Not in a theatrical way. No Latin. No theatrics. They walked the room the way you walk the border of a property you love. They prayed over the corners, over the bed, over the places where his fear lived. They prayed for him, too, hands on his shoulders, the murmuring tide of belief rising and falling until the shame he carried for cutting himself felt, for the first time in months, like something that could be laid down. 45 minutes. That's what he remembers. An ordinary span of time with nothing ordinary in it. When they finished, the pastor didn't ask him how he felt. He told him what to expect. Maybe nothing at first. Maybe noise later. Maybe the quiet would feel like the loudest thing of all. "But go to bed tonight," he said, "and tomorrow, and the next day. Don't invite anything. Don't ask questions into thin air. Don't ask boards for names." In the days that followed, it was as if the house exhaled. He didn't stop being sad overnight. Grief has its own stubborn mathematics. But the slicing compulsion eased. The blackouts didn't come. His mother stopped flinching when he walked into a room. He slept through the night for the first time in months and woke with the oddest sensation. Not happiness exactly, but the absence of that cold electricity. The silence of a switched-off machine. Was it an exorcism? He doesn't try to name it. Labels are for people who weren't there. All he knows is something shifted, and whatever had been pressing on his lungs for so long eased its grip. He says it this way. The room felt different, and he felt possible again. Years went by. He learned to live around the tender spots. The deja vu still stuttered through his days like edits in a film. Dreams still came, brighter and stranger than other people's, but he treated them like weather, something you carry an umbrella through, not a map. He swore off Ouija boards and anything that looked like one, even the app a friend tried to show him at a party. He learned to recognize his own hunger for contact as the danger it was. He learned to leave doors shut. A decade of quiet is a lifetime in the language of haunting, long enough to convince you that whatever once set its sights on you has moved along. Long enough to forget that Halloween is a hinge. 3 nights ago, he went to a party. South Florida wears Halloween like a crown. Heat still clinging to the air after midnight. Thunderstorms that feel theatrical by design. Clubs that look like they used to be something else. This one had been an old movie theater. Now it was a fetish night. He had heard of them, but words can't prepare you for the way a room decides it will be. Inside, the music was a war between heartbeat and machinery. Techno like a turbine. Death metal like the inside of a locked engine. People wore black the way a uniform wears a person. Leather and vinyl and latex that made bodies into sculptures. Gas masks. Priest collars inverted into mockery. Horns. Chains. It looked like Hellraiser commissioned a runway show. On the main stage, a man in demon makeup dragged a woman by a chain looped around her throat. The crowd shout rose and fell as if ocean-fed. He beat her, choreographed, stylized, consent signed somewhere else, and then the show went somewhere the eye can follow but the spirit hesitates to. Another performer arrived with flame, painting the ceiling with heat. A third came bearing a grotesque prosthetic, a theatrical device that sprayed stage blood across the bodies of the women on all fours. They bathed in it. Like it had always been theirs. You can call it art, you can call it kink, you can call it theater. But there in the dark, Kevin felt a current he recognized. Not because of the surface, but because of the undertow. He is honest about it. He is an extreme person. He liked the spectacle, the surrender, the way transgression can look like freedom. He left the club with a second heartbeat. He thought about going back. Of course, he thought about going back, and sometimes warnings don't come as thunderclaps. Sometimes they tap your shoulder through the everyday. The next morning, his mother texted, "When are you coming over?" He typed a reply, "Be there in 15. He sent it without thinking, a son's automatic message. The day unrolled the way days do, coffee, traffic, a sky that couldn't decide if it wanted to rain. Later, he went to clear his outbox. It should have been a small act, the digital equivalent of sweeping a kitchen. The message he sent to his mother was addressed to a number that wasn't hers. The screen read, "To 666, be there in 15. He stared. There was no plausible fat finger in this math. His mother's name is stored. The number is a contact, not a sequence. To 666, be there in 15. He did not laugh. He did not show it around like a novelty. He sat with the kind of cold that doesn't care what Florida thinks of humidity. Was it a glitch? Maybe. Was it a prank? Unlikely. Was it a message? The question is its own answer. Because here's a truth that often gets left out of sermons and skepticism alike. Whatever watches us is patient. It does not need to sprint when it has a lifetime to walk. It can wait 10 years. It can wait through healed skin and better sleep and the error-correcting algorithms of ordinary days. It can wait for a holiday built on pretty masks and open doors. It can wait for the moment a man with a history of opening gates steps into a theater remade into a temple of performance where blood is pretend and worship is real enough to fool the body. He remembers the pastor's language, doors, invitations, hunger. He remembers the warning about devices that seem like toys. He wonders now what counts as a device, a board, a stage, a night. He didn't tell his mother about the text. He didn't need her to be afraid of numbers. He told himself the old rational things because rational things are good rope when a tide pulls hard. But that night in bed, the dark felt a half degree heavier than the night before, and the hum of the air conditioner sounded, for just a second, like something breathing. He reached for his father's cross, where it lives still in the drawer beside his bed, and held it in his palm the way a diver holds air in his lungs. He thought about the times grief had tricked him into conversation with a board that killed questions and fed answers. He thought about the way a voice had known his name before he was old enough to drink or vote. He thought about the word suffering spelled with a planchette that used to be a living animal's tooth. He thought about an entity that gave itself three letters like a signature on a wall. He thought about a Florida phone glowing with a number you joke about until the joke isn't funny. He is 27 now. He is not a child who mistakes drafts for specters. He is not a teenager who chisels pain into his arms to make sense of weather in his skull. He is not a man who believes in easy endings. He tells this story not to shock, but to warn, and his warning is simple. Whether or not you believe in the spiritual world, it has never required your consent to believe in you. So what should he do? What should any of us do when the past sends an RSVP to the present with numbers stamped like a brand? He can choose not to go back to the theater. He can choose the old disciplines, sleep, light, prayer in the room that was once a battleground. He can keep the doors shut and the invitations unmailed. He can take the pastor's card, faded now at the corners, and tuck it in a wallet that holds more stories than cash. He can remember that fascination is a kind of hunger, and hunger is the way a thing that is not you learns to move your hands. He tells me he did not sleep well that night. Not because anything stood at the foot of his bed, and not because a weight pressed him until his ribs complained. He didn't sleep because nothing happened, and sometimes nothing is louder than a scream. Morning came anyway, the way morning always does. He made coffee. He checked his phone. No more messages to nowhere. For now, the door's closed. For now, the house is quiet. For now, the cross feels like metal in memory instead of a lock on a cage he can't see. For now, the number 666 is just a superstition you can laugh at if you want to. For now. But some stories don't sit quietly in the past. They bleed forward. They linger. They wait for the moment you forget you ever learned how to say no. And when that moment comes, when the music rises and the crowd chants, and a stage somewhere in a city that never goes to sleep, turns into the oldest altar in the world. Something remembers your name. It has never needed more than that.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.